are many ways you can support Write Up My Podcast, but we'd love it if you pick just one.
You can join our Rump Club via Patreon from as little as £3 a month.
Get exclusive access to behind-the-scenes content, the inside scoop on upcoming episodes, members-only workshops, no-holds-barred Gwen and Kate Wiffle Waffle, and more.
Simply head to patreon.com/writeupmypodcast. Or if you prefer to be a one-off supporter, you can send us a virtual coffee. Head to buymeacoffee.com/writeupmy.
Follow the links in our show notes and we will love you forever. Thank you.
It's right up my street, my boulevard. It's right up my Straza. Oh my God, it's garden right up there. Ah, it's right up my podcast.
Welcome to episode 24 of Write Up My Podcast. My name's Kate White.
And my name's Gwen Watson. And this is the podcast in which we talk to some really natty people with some really natty ideas for making you feel good.
Natty. Do you think Dr. Pamela Priscow describes herself as natty?
I'm just desperate to think of a different word, and that's what came out. Natty. I haven't used that.
But I love it. It's perfect. We do speak to natty people.
Whether they know it or not. What does natty mean? I'm not sure.
But anyway. It's anyway, how are you, doll?
I'm all right. Oh, yeah, so who are we talking to today? Who is the natty person lined up?
Today's natty guest is the very amazingly inspiring Dr. Pamela Priscow. She is a medical doctor based in British Columbia in Canada, and she is a researcher into psychedelic medicines. But I will give you a bit more information about her later. But I'll tell you what, it's a really fascinating chat.
It really is. And can I just say, for long listeners, tall and long listeners to the podcast, you will know that we've been trying to get a microdosing episode out since the first series.
Yes. So this has been on Gwen's hot list.
It has been. And so that's why we're a little late, because we wanted to do everything we could to get this into series three. So thank you for your patience, and hopefully it'll all be worth it.
Absolutely. And in all this extra time we've had on our hands, what have you been up to, Gwen?
Well,
there's the question.
It's February, isn't it? And I feel
nearly pancake
like,
day.
Oh yeah, no, pancake day's not even going to come until March. That's how.
Are you being serious?
Yeah, that's how shit this year is already.
Oh my God, come on already. Just go away, February.
Honestly. But no, it's been all right, but I have very little to report other than what I've been watching on Netflix, etc. And I've noticed a theme.
Yeah.
In the things that I've been watching and the things that other people have been watching. And that is, there's a theme of people pretending to be other people. And
as in acting? is this the theme you've cleverly
honestly
picked up
Kate
on?
This is gonna blow your mind, okay? All of these programs have got people they're actors what are pretending to be different people.
What is this crazy chap?
Stick me over here with my new theory. It's taken me a while to come up with this. So the first one I watched was Tinder Swindler on Netflix,
yes.
All about a guy who pretends to be like an heir to a diamond billionaire, and he's basically flouncing around the world in an exceedingly lavish and abhorrently lavish lifestyle whilst ripping off women around the world to fund it.
Oh, wow. Oh, my goodness.
That was hideous.
And this is real story?
True story.
Oh.
And he's still out there in the world.
Really?
Yeah.
He's never been caught?
Well, he has been caught. I don't want to give too much away.
Oh, okay.
But it's actually a bit of, I was like, oh, get the popcorn ready. People, they've met him on Tinder. They are wooed by his lavish lifestyle and fallen in love with him. I'm like, I'm going to love this. But actually, it's actually really depressing. It's actually really awful. These poor women, look, the women have had a bit of bad press and have been slammed for being so gullible, but they're just in love, and he's totally convinced them that he's in love with them and that they're getting married. And
It's scary, isn't it? Because actually, when you're putting yourself out there and trying to meet someone new and making yourself vulnerable, which you've got to do in order to develop a relationship with someone else, you can kind of see how sometimes the blinkers are on.
Yes.
And it sounds like, I mean, I've not watched this, and so it sounds like it's a real extreme case of, but, you know, we've all sort of done stupid things when we are in love with someone, when we think they're in love with us. And then afterwards you look back and you're like, what? I said what?
Yeah.
Did I really think that?
I lent him over £100,000 in the first month. What?
Yeah, I've not done that.
I think for some of us, there may have been some alarm bells. But yes, when you're in love, you just let... You really do believe, you want to believe what this person is telling you.
Because you just want it to be real.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because you think it's real. Anyway, so that is a harrowing tale of... But also, yeah, as I was saying, not only is he awful, but he's just got this really awful, lavish lifestyle, which just made me think, my God, some of the lives that people lead, honestly. Yeah. The yachts, the planes, the private jets, the casinos... The holidays to Dubai, et cetera, et cetera.
Is it one of those things where you're like, oh, it's just a little bit gross?
Yeah,
like
it's totally gross.
Yeah, totally gross.
And kind of on that theme, actually, is Inventing Anna, which is another one which, you know, you grab the popcorn for. It's what's-her-face. Oh, God, I'm awful. I don't know her name from Ozark. You know the curly blonde girl in Ozark? Julie.
Oh, yeah, she's incredible in Ozark.
She's incredible.
Yeah.
I feel like we should definitely say her name. Shall I Google it?
Yes. Oh, my God. I can't even remember the name of her. Ruth. She plays the character Ruth in Ozark.
Right. And in this, she plays Anna Delvey, who is also known as... She's a convicted con artist and fraudster. Her actual name's Anna Sorokin. And between the years of 2013 and 2017, she pretended to be a wealthy heiress... And was arrested after allegedly defrauding banks, hotels and acquaintances for a total of $275,000. And she's played by Julia Garner. There we go.
Okay.
Who is absolutely perfect. I think she's absolutely brilliant in the role. And she's got the oddest accent because this woman kind of hails from Russia and Germany.
Right.
And then has been living in the States as well. And apparently the accent is very accurate. But yeah,
wow.
Just once again, living an exceedingly lavish lifestyle. But just the balls of these people, the absolute balls.
Yeah.
To then be asking people for tens of thousands of dollars to support their lifestyle.
I'd be really interested to see a character profile of those sort of people, if they all come under the same sort of character profile. Obviously, sociopaths.
Yes.
Like total lack of empathy.
I think they must be sociopaths.
Yeah. To be able to treat people like that. And to I don't believe for a minute that they don't know the devastation that they're causing through that behaviour.
Surely. Surely.
Crazy.
Go on.
Would you recommend, or is it just too depressing?
No. Tinder swindler, probably avoid that one.
But
Inventing Anna is brilliant. It is.
Yeah.
I think it's but just like an exercise in, oh my God, just the bravado. It's like, I wish I had half an ounce of that confidence that she's got. My God. Walking in, she was very nearly lent $40 million by a bank. Like she was this close to getting it. And
so she's just able to talk herself into that situation.
Yes, and basically talked herself into the New York elite.
Wow.
And fooled them all.
Wow.
So that's amazing. And the other thing I've been watching is Chloe on BBC. So slightly differently, she's pretending to be somebody else in order to find out what happened to a childhood friend who has lost her life. And but it's, you're just tense. You're like, I had to take a break after a few episodes because you're like, oh my God, she's going to be found
out. I hate shows like that when you're just like, oh God, just every episode is just an exercise in nerves and like you said, sort of low-level stress bubbling along.
I know. I literally don't know how these people do it. But anyway, do you know what's interesting though? After watching these shows, a couple of my friends have said, oh, I wish I could do that. I wish I could go and pretend to be somebody else for a day.
Yeah.
And which I have to admit, I just kind of think I bloody couldn't.
No.
I mean, for a start, my memory's terrible. I would forget what I've told person A and person B. But could you? I just think that would be really stressful.
There is a slightly glamorized idea of talking yourself in to something. Like what you were saying about that woman with the sort of the New York elite, by having the absolute bare brass balls to talk yourself into some really exclusive place. I don't know. I have at times, like, my low level entry into that is like blagging myself into posh toilets that I probably shouldn't be allowed to go into. Just like walking super confidently, be like, yes, to the doorman. Yes, I am going to go and take a pee in your toilet. What are you going to do about it? I'm a glamorous lady. You don't want to say no. That's how I get my
He's
buzz.
Like, well, come on in, glamorous lady. These toilets are obviously for you.
You are welcome to use our facilities. What an expert con woman she is. That's the extent of it.
Oh my God, I had no idea I that know. I was presenting podcasts with such a brave,
dark,
confident
dark
woman.
Alter ego. Quake in my shoes.
Absolutely love that. You are an inspiration to all of us, Kate. If we want to,
has
if we
said.
Yeah. So, listener, if you would like to join me on entry-level conmanship, then yes, let's make it into the posh toilets.
Yeah, start for one step at a time. One day it's posh toilets. Next day you're sitting at the bar drinking free champagne.
Next day you're on holiday at an exclusive resort in Morocco, charging your mate $62,000 to pay for it.
Easy money.
It's right up my podcast.
Now, just a reminder about our Patreon page. This is where we put our extras from our episodes and where we put all our jingles, and also where Kate and I do a little bit of extra wiffle waffle just for your delectation.
Now, we don't rely on advertising in order to fund the production of Right Up My Podcast, but we do have a Patreon page where we would love it if you could go over and if you can donate the cost of a cup of coffee once a month. That would just help to cover the time and the costs that Gwen and I spend in putting these episodes together, cover the time of our talented team who help us out and help us keep producing episodes of Right Up My Podcast with fabulous guests that we know you'd love to listen to.
If you'd like to become one of our supporters, head on over to Patreon.com/writeupmypodcast. So this is episode 24 on microdosing.
Yes, and this episode we speak to Dr. Pamela Crisco. Now, Pamela is a Canadian doctor based in British Columbia who specializes in psychedelic medicine, mental health, and chronic pain. She's a founding board member of the Canadian Psychedelic Association and also part of an expert team working to give Canadians access to psilocybin at the end of life. She's also actively involved in research related to psilocybin, MDMA, ketamine, mental wellness, and neurogenesis. And in addition to this, Pamela is also a co-investigator on the largest ongoing microdosing study to date, microdose.me. She's a clinical instructor at the University of British Columbia and a professor at Vancouver Island University, plus the medical lead on the Roots to Thrive ketamine-assisted therapy program that treats healthcare providers and frontline workers with PTSD, depression, anxiety, and addiction. So she's a fascinating person to speak to. But before we get into our conversation with Pamela, I think that we should probably say at the top here that in this episode, as you've probably worked out, we do talk about substances that are currently illegal in the UK. And I do think we've got a responsibility to say at this point that we are not encouraging anyone in any way to engage with these substances, and certainly not as a substitute for any existing mental health treatment that someone might be undergoing, unless they're doing it in a safe environment with an experienced therapist. We are just exploring this area of research because it's bloomin' totally fascinating. We started our interview with Pamela by asking her, what are the health benefits of psilocybin?
I think the benefits, to answer your question more widely, is really the whole health, whole human health, right? We're not just our mental wellness. We're not just our physical wellness. We're a whole person. And so that's what we're looking at. We're looking at how can we help with products, bringing the right products, or at least knowing which products will help with whole human health. So not only help if you have depression and maybe you have a nerve disorder or chronic pain, but that's the research we're looking at. And some of it's getting teased apart into mental wellness, and some of it's getting teased apart into unmet needs such as Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, multiple sclerosis, cerebellar ataxia, those type of neurodegenerative conditions. And some of it also just applies to just feeling better, feeling happier, feeling more creative.
So the use of these substances in ways that you've just been talking about has got quite a checkered history, hasn't it? Can you just maybe give us a sort of potted background of what's gone before as far as sort of research and understanding?
Great question. Yeah. So if we want, we should define what we're talking about. You're talking about like psilocybin, classic psychedelics like MDMA, LSD, plant and fungi, obviously like psilocybin mushrooms, peyote, ayahuasca, wachuma. You know, these are things that have been around on the earth for how long? Who knows? I don't know. Somebody smarter than
longer
me knows
than
how
us.
Long they've been around. So they've much longer than us. And they've been used ceremonially in our cultures. Wherever you lived on this planet, you would have had something that would have caused altered states, whether it was a plant, fungi, or a ceremony such as sweat lodges or sun dances, etc. And we actually had in North America a lot of research going on, especially on LSD and psilocybin. In the 50s and 60s in Canada, in Saskatchewan, we had a whole an insane asylum is what they would have called it at the time. Yeah. We wouldn't call it that now. But Weyburn, in Weyburn, Saskatchewan, they were doing really great research on psilocybin and LSD for conditions such as depression, alcoholism, and getting really good results. MDMA started picking up steam a lot in the 70s and 80s. And in fact, it was becoming a really largely used and taught within the psychiatric and psychologist groups. And so that research was going quite well. But of course, you know, sometimes politicians don't like what was going on. And in the U.S., Nixon didn't like that people maybe weren't going to go to war. They weren't going to listen. They wanted to go listen to music and dance with their friends and have fun. And that didn't really fit with what he thought was appropriate. And they thought that, you know, you can't really criminalize people for having fun, but you can criminalize their drugs. And so he really had a concerted effort, brought it to the UN and you know, the UN Declaration on Drugs happened, and all countries had to fall into line. And so these substances, which really should have been considered medications, then moved from use, science, research, and recreation to being criminalized. And we've had about a 40-year hiatus on this. And now, fortunately, there's enough momentum now that they're coming back. They're coming back into research. They're coming back into use. It's really a time of excitement, I think, in that research is opening. You know, John Hopkins really opened the door. They worked really hard to get their first study out on end-of-life distress. And, you know, a lot of us saw that and went, wow, maybe there's an opportunity here to overcome the propaganda. And that's really what your question is like, how do we get here? It's called propaganda.
Right? Yeah.
And it just shows how susceptible we are to propaganda, especially propaganda done well, you know. And when we think about, oh, what is the stigma? It's really interesting to think, why is there stigma based on propaganda? Because propaganda is effective. And so you have to be intellectual about it. You have to be smart, and you have to move into an adult conversation about this, that was an error. That was an error in history, because we all come from some place on this planet as indigenous people someplace, and many of us migrated to other places. And we would have had some sort of ceremonial use of this. And now I think what's happening is we're combining the two. We're bringing ceremonial use back into science, and then finding this new way of walking forward together.
So this is a really exciting time for people in your field with your expertise to be pushing the boundaries of knowledge and what we know. I mean, that's exciting.
Well, it's a good time. Science, it's always a good time for science. It's because everyone's a scientist. We're all scientists, right? Do I like this food? Do I not like this food? Does this food make me feel better? Or does this technique make me feel better? Does yoga help me or not? We're all scientists, and it's a great time to be curious. It's a great time to ask why, how come. You do have, you know, people that are looking for alternatives, you know, from the biological model of medicine that is like, oh, your depression, you get the depression pill.
Yeah.
you know, like looking at us as symptoms.
Yeah.
You know, in medicine, we were, you know, a whole group of physicians were trained very strongly in patients are a symptom and this is the model. And the reality is the generations of physicians coming up now, many just don't believe that. And they're like, you're a person. How do we help the whole person? How do we all help every part of us, our creativity, our minds, our physical, spiritual, every part of that? And so that push from both sides of the spectrum, the older and the younger, saying, I want better, I want more, is opening those doors. And how can you even argue, you know, with the numbers? You can't. Like in medicine, if I use an SSRI, an antidepressant, you know, the data looks at maybe for most patients, when you average it, they're going to get a 30 to 40% benefit, where placebo benefit is about 30%.
Right.
So they're going to get about 10% better than placebo. Now, there's some people that respond a lot better. Like some people, those medications work for phenomenally, and there's other people that they don't work at all. But then you look at something like PTSD with MDMA, when MAPS is doing their trials, and you're getting, you know, people that have 17 years of PTSD, they have tried everything. They have tried every medication, they have tried every therapy, and after 3 MDMA sessions, their diagnosis of PTSD is greatly diminished or gone.
Yeah.
Who, if you're a physician, which treatment do you want?
Yeah, yeah.
For your patient, which treatment? I want my patient to get MDMA if they have PTSD. I don't want to put them on a drug for 17 years and have them living, not being able to show up for their families or their friends or do what they want or go camping or hiking, you know. And it's the same sort of thing with psilocybin. You know, we see, you know, great reductions in addiction. You know, smoking cessation, alcoholism, violence.
Through the use of psilocybin.
Yeah, yeah. And what the meds really do, which the pharmaceuticals don't do, is the psychedelic meds get to the seed of the problem.
Yeah.
Right? Like if you had really terrible parenting, like if your parents were just not able to be good parents for whatever reason and they inflicted trauma, you know, how do you heal that with an antidepressant? When the problem is needing to be loved and accepted, you know, reparented. And these medications done well, done in a good situation with a good therapist or a good team of therapists or good friends or whatever it is, you know, you get to that seed of I'm not good enough, I'm not lovable, I'm not wonderful. You go back and you go, actually, my parents didn't do a great job. They couldn't have done better. That's all they had. That's all the skills I had. And I'm not that person anymore.
Yeah.
You know? And then you move forward. No drug does that. Like no pharmaceutical drug does that.
And that's why pharmaceuticals are not interested in it, because where's the money in that being fixed in 3 sessions?
Not a good financial model.
So we're talking about treating conditions such as depression, anxiety, PTSD, you talked about addiction, end-of-life anxiety. These are the conditions that we're talking about that that you're focusing your research on.
Yeah, and neurological, you know. When you look at something like Parkinson's, it has many elements, right? It has a neurophysiological, yeah. You know, you get the mask facies, you get the pill rolling, you get the stooped gait, you get balance issues and many other things, but you also get a depression. You also get a dysthymia, like a low mood. And so looking at that intersection of how something like psilocybin mushrooms can actually hit both.
What does clinical research look like? How are you actually, for people who have absolutely no awareness of this, what does it look like for person A to come into your clinic? How are they treated and how are they tested?
Okay, so I just want to clear, like, so you're talking about clinical therapy versus clinical trials, right? You're talking about clinical therapy. What does that look like?
Well, actually, now I don't know. I thought I was talking about, I guess you're doing both, right?
We are doing both.
Yeah.
So when it came to using psilocybin mushrooms for our end-of-life patients, what happened in Canada, and Canada is maybe a bit unique from the UK, but we had a system where patients could apply for an exemption for access to these medicines. And so we had 9 patients who had applied and received their exemptions to use psilocybin mushrooms. And so then what we did is we have a program called Roots to Thrive, which is group psychedelic therapy. And our normal program that runs, it's a 12-week program. We have 3 psychedelic ketamine-assisted therapy sessions embedded in it because ketamine is a legal psychedelic-like medicine. And it works quite well for PTSD, depression, anxiety, eating disorders, addiction. And so our program is catered to health, like frontline healthcare workers, first responders like firefighters and paramedics, and generally people with PTSD. And so what we did is we recreated that program shorter because the people that were coming in with psilocybin have end-of-life issues. And so what does that look like? You know, it's a proper medical intake to make sure that it's safe for them to use psilocybin. It's a proper psychiatric review to make sure that they're stable enough to be able to come to the session and show up for the sessions after to integrate and ongoing therapy. And then it's preparation. Once they get accepted into a therapeutic program like ours, then, you know, we prepare them to make sure all their questions are answered, help get them ready for the ceremonial aspect. Our program is very ceremonial. We have Indigenous elders on our team. And what we're trying to do is close that circle, the Western and the Indigenous, pull it all back together, knowing that we're all on the same team. We all want wellness. And how can we all work together? Because science is just part of us, period. It's not separate from who we are or from Indigenous traditions at all. And so we bring all that back. We make sure they're prepared for the session. We make sure, you know, they know what their intentions are. We make sure their family and their friends are prepared to welcome them after and help support them after. And then we have the session the day of, very ceremonial, held by a very skilled therapeutic team, multidisciplinary. So we have therapists, we have somatic therapists, we have energy workers, we have psychiatrists, nurses, you know, it's multiple levels of a team with no hierarchy in our team. Everyone's the same level. And then the ceremony, and then right after, in the days following, integration with their peers that have gone through the same thing together. So they're all having their session together. And they get to share it. It's a shared experience. It's shared community. And that's another thing we're really craving, which is why we chose to do it in community, because we're craving connection to each other. We're craving love and acceptance, you know, and that, you know, we become insular. We need to come back together and hang out and support each other. And then the group is done and they're still supporting each other. They're still getting together. They're still talking about their experience and the uniqueness of traveling your life, knowing that you do have a life-ending diagnosis.
Yeah. And is it accompanied by talk therapy or any other kind of, talking or listening therapy alongside that?
Yeah, it's integrated into the group. The group meets together 2 hours a week. So what we do is we use all the best psychodynamic theories, all the best psychotherapy modalities, and we take little bits and pieces that work the best to move people along, you know, help them get out of the story and help them get into healing. Help with, you know, unconditional positive regard is something we use, like that you are worthy no matter what, period. You just show up, you are worthwhile. Everybody's worthwhile. We're all traveling a path of trying to be a better version of ourselves. And we can walk that path together. And if you have shame, so do I. So it's all good. Yeah. Like it's okay. We can talk about it. We don't have to hide in the corner thinking I'm the only one that's broken, or I'm the only one with this problem. I'm unlovable. No one will, if they knew what had happened or what I've done, they would hate me. Well, it's just not true. It's not true. And so we open that up in a very safe environment. So yes, a lot of talk, a lot of sharing, a lot of compassionate listening, just listening and going, I hear you. That sounds like shit. You know, like just honesty. So yeah. Yeah.
Sounds incredible.
So
sounds incredible.
But it's a mix. It's a mix.
you just said. Ooh, yes, I thought so. Ah, yeah. I like what I hear. Ooh, yeah. Tell me more, please, when you're ready.
How do people, presumably some of these people have never done any recreational drugs before, let alone psychedelics. So how is that for people stepping out of their comfort zone and for letting go of control? It's how do people respond to it?
Well, most people have had some form of altered state, like in meditation, even for 30 seconds. Or maybe if they've done something exciting, like gone on a really high water slide, that few moments of out of control, but good. And some people have never had anything, and they're really, and because of their trauma, they're really controlling. Like they really need to control their environment. And so we just walk with them very gently. You know, the main thing is you have to trust your therapy team. And so if we can prove ourselves trustworthy to each and every participant, then we can get them to a place of trusting us, where we will hold them safe. We will be there for them. That we cannot control what their journey, their psychedelic session will be like. When I say journey, meaning their session. But we'll be there for them. We'll be there. We know that we will hold them physically safe. And then no matter what comes up, we will walk with them to help that. Because you have to shake it up, right? Like you have to shake it up to move on. You have to crack it a little bit.
Yeah.
And like sometimes we use the analogy of a snow globe. You know, psychedelics can be like a gentle snow globe or a violent snow globe. But then the pieces settle nicely. And the next few days can be challenging, but it's worth it because you don't want to live the way you used to live. Like that's the whole thing, right? Like people come into these programs or going to want to do psychedelic therapy because they're done. It's like, I don't want to live my life this way. I know I deserve better. There's a little voice in my head that says, I deserve better. And that's what these therapies can do when you hold it in a really solid, safe, therapeutic container, is you can get to that place where you can go and really take a look at those things. And sometimes you don't even have to look at them. Like I've had people that have had very violent traumas, like unspeakable, go through a psychedelic session and release it in the most peaceful way.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't have to be hard. The other option we always say to our participants, it can also be fun. You can also go in this altered space and have a lot of fun while you play with your trauma, while you look at it in a different way. You know, it doesn't have to be work. It can be fun work. Okay. It can be work too. Like it can be mucky and yucky, but that's what the therapeutic team is there to say, yeah, good for you. Good for you. You did it. And now we're going to hold you tight and carefully so you can process it and take it to the next level. And we never promise the moon, right? It's always, I think of it like a video game. You know, you're at level one today and you try to get to level two. And then when you acclimatize to level two, you try to get to level three. And then you try to get to level four. And life's like that. You don't go from level zero to the top of the mountain. Very rarely. There's few people that get that experience. But it's a journey, right? It's like, get to the next level. Ah, this is my life here now, and now I want a bit better. How do I get to the next level?
I was going to ask, do we know yet what is happening in someone's brain then when they're on psilocybin?
Well, this is very interesting. Every time we're working on a protocol for a clinical trial, we almost always have in the room the people that want to image the brain. Mm. Right? And, you know, we've come a long ways. A lot smarter. The machines are a lot better. They measure a lot more things. But we're really not fully at that stage. And I'm happy to be corrected by somebody who knows a lot more about this. I am not an expert in this area, but I always ask the experts on our team that this is their expertise. How do we know that what you're seeing here means this in reality, like in behavior or a change. Like if you see this in the imaging, does it always mean that the depression is getting better? Or if you see this in the imaging, does it always, like some things there are connections, but I don't think we have enough connections. I don't think there's enough there. So it's a fascinating area to study. And I'm really glad that there's super smart people studying that. And I don't think we have it. So, you know, you're going to see a lot of devices. You're going to see a lot of, you know, MRIs and PET scans and functional disc scans and all sorts of stuff. Keep doing it. Let's figure it out. But I don't think that we have that connection. If this, then this in real life. Right. And remember mechanisms of actions for a lot of these, like, you know, when you look at like an SSRI and serotonin, like serotonin has like, I think something like 14 binding sites in the body. Which ones for which person? Right. And then you look at something like psilocybin that has many, many constituents that are going to be acting on different receptors. So like we're complex.
Yeah.
Right. And I don't know that we're smart enough to understand our complexity yet. Or I don't know that we'll ever be smart enough to understand our complexity of the complexity of a fungi, which is a kingdom of its own, the complex mixed with the complexity of a mammal, us interacting in some sort of way. So curious, yes, but I don't know that there's an answer. Like, how does it work on the brain? Why, if you had 10 people taking the same dose, are they going to have 10 different experiences?
This is my next question, actually, because obviously you're trialing this and giving therapy to people who are all coming to you for different reasons. And so everybody's having different experiences. And it's going to have different impacts. But are there themes in the experiences that people are having? Like I've heard, for example, and I don't know if this is true but or correct science, but that it when you do a high enough dose of, say, psilocybin, that it strips away all your neural pathways or all your conditioning that you've built up and all your beliefs, and you get back to like your core. And my experience has been that you come out of it kind of all the little daily concerns that you had, you kind of they drop by the wayside, and you kind of actually just feel love, and you feel connection, and you feel connection with the universe. And I'm just kind of wondering, is there a theme to people's experiences? Is there something that you can kind of say, yes, having this experience or having this therapy brings this experience?
There's definitely themes. You know, it's very common for people to say, you know, I felt that I was really in touch with who I really am. You know, like you said, all the layers were stripped away. We often say ego, like yeah. Ego death, like not, it doesn't die. I think of it more, the ego kind of sits on the couch and lets the big kids play.
Yeah, right.
You know, I think of the ego as a dictator. And you just get to put it over there and go, okay, now the big kids are going to show up, the big brain. So yes, definitely universal, like love, connectedness. We know people on psilocybin mushrooms appreciate nature so much more. They're much more scientifically curious. The common themes around addiction, very commonly people say, you know, I used to smoke. I have no desire for that. It just doesn't make sense anymore. You know, the alcohol, even like people that drink a lot, you hear that a lot. It just doesn't make sense. Like, why would I do that?
Yeah.
You know, it just changes. So something, whereas it's, I need it to help my anxiety, or it calms me, or it relaxes me to like, I don't need that.
Yeah.
Why would I use that? So that's very common. Very often it's common that the themes of like forgiveness, you know, kind of this way of, especially, you know, we have these memories of when we're children, how things were. And it's, you know, you get a bigger picture of it. You know, you get to kind of have your adult brain going, oh, it was much more than that. You know, like there was a bigger picture there. And, you know, you've heard Paul Stamets often say, like, you know, we walk through life with seeing the world like this, a thin slice of reality. And the psychedelics can widen those blinders. And so to what you were saying, you know, you have more possibilities. You realize that, oh, I don't have to do it that way. I can also do it this way. You know, you just have a wider view. And so in those hours after, after a good session, like if you're doing a spiritual dose, like a bigger dose, a transformative dose versus microdosing, you know, you're in a period of neuroplasticity where you can make different options. You can take different options. You've presented yourself, because it's your internal journey, with alternatives. You're getting out of your way. And we also know that your amygdala, which is protecting you, so especially if you've had some trauma or even layers of trauma, little traumas that have got up there, and now you're in like, you know, the world's dangerous, that suddenly the amygdala is like, pretty safe.
Yeah,
it's okay.
Right.
Go have fun.
Okay.
You know, you start to see that. You start to see people moving out of their safety behaviors. And re-embracing the world that is truly mostly safe.
Yeah, my friends who've from my friends' experience from doing a larger dose is often to say it feels like hitting the reset button.
Yeah, yeah, and we say that a lot, like in our program, like there's a lot of things like that. Like there's a theory around I won't get into the receptors, but just in plain language, saying like there's a theory that like anxiety is like a repetitive use injury. Like, you know, when you see a cashier at the store and they're always moving, they're swiping, and then they get the carpal tunnel, they get the repetitive injury, that you can get the same thing in your brain. Like one of the theories is you can get this looping. You just keep creating this pathway that's first a path, and then it's a road, and then it's a paved highway.
Right, yeah.
Right? And you get this looping, and the psychedelics can like stop the loop, and there's another meadow over here. Why don't we walk through the meadow and create a new path that then becomes a walkway, that then becomes, you know, a little road, and go over there and let this one grow over. Let this one go back to, you know. So yeah, so there's like that. There's the repetitive injury belief. There's obviously the neuroplasticity. If you're constantly looping, that's going to be, your brain's always looking for the easy way of doing things. That's why the first time you drive a car, you're like, oh my God, overload. There's so many things to do. And now you hop in a car and you're like, you don't even think about it, because your brain has created these pathways that are super easy to use. So definitely a reset button. Absolutely. I think. And just even if it doesn't reset you, it's like, I have options.
Yeah.
I have some different options.
A different outlook.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about your microdosing study that you're currently running, microdosing.me?
Yeah, thanks. So a number of years back, you know, when microdosing was really taking off in Silicon Valley, and probably, like, I mean, it probably goes back millennia. In fact, I know it does, because I know ayahuasca was microdosed and is microdosed, but chuma has been microdosed. And I'm sure psilocybin mushrooms had been microdosed, you know, when we go back to our roots. But Silicon Valley was really doing a lot of LSD. A lot of programmers were using it for microdosing for attention. And I had come across a study that was on Quantified Citizen that was interesting. It was on microdosing, but they were asking about creativity and happiness kind of stuff. And I thought, well, that's interesting, but I'm a doctor. I want to know, what does it actually do? Because I was getting all these case reports and I was following it, and people were saying all these things, and I was super skeptical, like, no way. Like, how can this practice do so many things? So
can I just quickly can I just quickly ask you to explain to listeners who maybe have not come across this term before what exactly microdosing is? Like, I mean, it kind of says what it does on the tin, but how much of a dose is it?
So, you know, we kind of think of microdosing as about 1/10 to 1/20 of a dose of what you would take for a spiritual dose. So are like a journey dose or a transformative dose. So if you know, you take 5 grams of mushrooms, then, you know, taking way less than that. And it's kind of like that, you know, we talk about it at the subsensorium dose, but it's also at the therapeutic dose. That might be a better word to use. So it's like, you know, when you take a medication, like if somebody's taking an antidepressant, they don't feel that they just took it, but they are feeling better, right?
Yeah.
Like they don't feel it and go, oh. So that's what we mean when we're talking about microdosing. So you're taking it at a therapeutic level, but it's not at a dose that you're feeling altered, as if you had taken a psychedelic dose. So I like to use, and our team likes to use three terms. So microdosing for where you're not feeling it at all. Macrodosing on the other end, where you're having, like, you're laying down, you're not moving, you're not going anywhere. And then in between, there's a lot of elite athletes that use what I would call a mini dose. So they'll have a little bit where they're feeling slightly enhanced, and they might go snowboarding or mountain biking, or they might go for a long distance run, and they're just in the zone, like they're in the zone right now. And they'll just say, it's just like the colors are beautiful, the sounds are amazing, they just get in the rhythm, they just, everything is just aligned. Those are the three terms that people will often hear. And then microdosing is like the therapeutic lower dose. Okay.
So when you're talking about people in Silicon Valley, sorry to go back to your story, people in Silicon Valley microdosing on LSD, they're taking a very small amount that they can still obviously work with. Or do they?
Yeah, they feel really focused. They feel like they can problem solve quicker, that the coding goes quicker. They just feel in the zone. It's in the zone, but they're not altered. Mm. Right? You know, like they could hop in a car and drive or jump on a bike and pedal, and they would just feel normal. They're not, just focused.
They're not lying under their desks at this point.
They're not lying under their desk. No. No, they're not. They're not doing that. But yeah, so I looked at the app, Quantified Citizen, and I talked to the two co-founders, and I said, could we do something a lot more interesting to me as a doctor? Could you guys bring in every validated study that we could do on an app that I would do with my patients in my office? And let's get more data. Let's find out if it's actually working. Let's find out if microdosing actually works. And so what we did is we grabbed every mood disorder, like the PHQ-9, the GAD-7, and a bunch more. And so these are things that I would do as a doctor. Like if you came in and said, you know, I think I'm depressed and I'm anxious, I would have you do these scales. These are validated studies. Meaning when I say a validated study, it means that they have been through enough testing to know that if your score shows you're depressed, you're depressed. Mm-hmm. And if your score shows you're not depressed, you're not depressed. So when we say validated studies in medicine, it just means that it is actually measuring what we think it's measuring.
Okay.
Consistently. And so we grabbed all the ones around mood for, you know, anxiety. We put a whole bunch in about creativity. And then we also put in everything we could put in that tested physical things like eyesight, hearing, reaction times, memory, creativity, picking out patterns, and we put them all in the app. And then we launched it to see, and we just said, anyone can enter anonymously. So people came in, they would put some of their demographics in, which country they're from, if they wanted, like, and they could put in with their age, their gender identification, why they were microdosing, and trying to think of what else. And then we took them through, and then they would go through a 3-month where they would go through an initial battery of all the tests. And then some of them were daily, some of them were weekly, some of them were monthly, and then for 3 months. And that's what we did. And that's what we're still doing. So there's about 15,000 people that have come in to that. And the interesting thing is, and microdosing anything. So what are you microdosing? How often are you microdosing? At what dose are you microdosing? And we're trying to just get the trends. What is happening out there? And do you think it's working? And do your tests that you're doing show it's working? Right? And so we had lots of people come in, all sorts of LSD, psilocybins, a lot of people combining psilocybin with lion's mane and vitamin B3, some with other mushrooms like reishi or shaga. Then there are some people that were doing some mescaline, DMT, ayahuasca with chuma. Missed a few.
Were people using MDMA and ketamine on this, or are they included in this? Do people microdose on those?
You know, MDMA, not so much. Like it doesn't seem to be one of the ones that people microdose on. It doesn't seem to have that low threshold. And ketamine, yeah, definitely we had some people on ketamine, and there's a lot of ketamine microdosing, and especially in depression. You see that. Yeah, and so then we looked at it, and you know, the trends, again, it's you know, we had actually about half the people that entered were not microdosing at all, which was interesting. They just wanted to do all the tests.
Fair enough.
Which was fantastic. Like, we didn't expect that. We did not expect that. And so we kind of had a built-in comparison group. Like, here's the people that came in and aren't microdosing and did all the tests. And here's the people that are microdosing and did all the tests.
Perfect.
And then we can compare them. Yeah. Now, it's not a perfect, it's not a perfect approach. It's a, what I would think of is it's an exploratory. Like, who's doing it? Why are they doing it? Why are, what are they hoping to get from it? And then do they get that? Do they get those results? You know, and then the next step from that is looking at those numbers and those signals and going, where are the trends? Where are we seeing the positive movement? And then you take it, then you start taking that into clinical trials, because now you know that there's some signal there, right? You're not guessing. And when you get enough people, you know, it's not clean data. It's called kind of called like dirty data, but that still doesn't matter. The trends are there. Because that's what you need, right? You see, oh, there's a trend here. Now, is it real? That's the next step. And so we've got a version 2 coming out. It'll launch in March or April. And what we did in this one, which was fun, is we cleaned up the... We made mistakes, right? You always make mistakes in any study. You wish like, oh, damn, I wish we would have done that differently. And so we took all the criticisms and all the questions and we go, how can we make it better? Made a better version. And the interesting thing is we had so many people that were microdosing that said, how come you didn't include us? Do you know, like us women, we have this focus group, or not a focus group, a group that comes together on postmenstrual dysphoria disorder. Oh. We're microdosing and it's working for us. How come you didn't study us? I'm like, happy to. Let's so we'd meet with people, I'd meet with all these groups all over the world and say, why are you microdosing? What doses? What are kind of the schedules you're doing? And what are the benefits? And how would we ask that? How would we ask the questions correctly for this? So patient-oriented research. You know, you're the person with the challenge. What's the best way to be studied? Asking people how do we study this? And so the new version is going to have a whole bunch more stuff, a whole bunch more stuff around sexuality, a whole bunch of stuff more around menstrual challenges and menstrual disorders, a lot more about pain, you know, and because we really had to figure out how to tease that apart because there's so many types of pain and it presents so differently. That was really challenging. And and making the other tests a little bit better. And again, we'll just get the trends. We'll find out what are people doing, and then hopefully we can move those into good clinical trials.
This is my potato, and these are my courgettes. What a lovely onion, majestical red pepper. Chop them all up, dice them up. Don't forget the mushroom. Grab a pan, add some oil. Throw all the veggies in. Sizzle and fry, add garlic and salt. Stir it all up, cover with a lid. Yes. Hush now, time to take your eggs out. Crack them, whisk them, pour them. Stir them, mix them. Add the cheese now. Under the grill, 3 minutes later, serve on toast.
So I know that the microdose.me research is very much still a work in progress, but what are the trends showing so far? Is microdosing working?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the interesting thing too that is which we added in version 2, because it's an interesting question, is like, if you're depressed or suicidal and you start microdosing, right? And it starts getting you better and you're better. And then you start exercising and then you start eating better and then you start hanging out with your friends. Do you need microdosing anymore?
Yeah.
Right? And so do you stop microdosing because you just don't need it anymore? You know, like we have all these kind of questions. So we're going to try to integrate this into the new version, is that people stop asking them, why did you stop? Not working? I stopped because it's not working. Or I stopped, I just felt I didn't need it anymore. I feel great.
Yeah.
Or my problem went away, right? Like, there's a lot of unanswered questions on this. So yeah, we saw, you know, the trends are certainly see people feeling happier, reporting they're happier, reporting their mood is better, reporting that their negative thought patterns have decreased and that they feel that they have more positive thoughts. We've had a really interesting finding of reaction time in the TAP test getting much better, especially in people over 55. So there's something, you know, that at what level do you start to kind of lose things? Like, when do you lose your, start to not have great eyesight or great hearing, or maybe your taste is, or your smell, or like that, you know, like at what level, like you, where we didn't find any difference in people under 55 for the reaction time, but certainly over 55 suddenly.
Fascinating.
So, you know, it might, so again, that might answer a question like, oh, who and when should microdose at what age? Well, if you have a history of dementia in your family, maybe you want to start microdosing at 40, you know, so you don't go down that dementia pathway. Or, you know, if you are starting to notice word finding, you want to start microdosing. So again, it's not going to be exact. It's not going to be Lego. It's not going to be like, oh, everyone gets this at this age, at this dose. It's going to be different. It's going to be, oh, if you're a, you know, a menstruating woman, maybe you're going to microdose for 1 week before your period, and that's all you need.
Okay.
For the month. And then next month you do it again. You know, and stuff like that. And then also COVID. We're putting COVID long in the new one, because I have so many people that have reported that they are doing the stack, the psilocybin lines, main and B3 for COVID long and getting good results. And so,
oh, great.
You know,
getting back to feeling themselves again.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. The brain fog and the loss of the taste and loss of smell, especially.
Just to look at the kind of the full picture, I guess, have you had any reports of any unwanted side effects that people are experiencing? Any trends in that as a result of microdosing?
Right. Well, we didn't ask that. So we're asking it now in the new version. Like, yeah. And like I said, you always wish you had asked things once you launch it, you're like, oh, how could we have forgotten to ask that? Well, we did. And that's science. That was our mistake, and we own it. And we're adding it in for version two to ask people, like, did you have an adverse reaction? And that again is interesting, right? Because again, these are not legal substances. I talk about, like, they're not yet legal. So how do you know, like, if somebody says, yeah, I was vomiting all night because of it. Like, how do you know if it's because of what they took for the microdose or because of the meal they had, or maybe what they got was contaminated, or, you know? And so that's where the clinical trials will help, because you know that if you use mushrooms and you know the mushrooms are really what they're the right mushrooms, you'll know that they're getting the right dose, and we'll get better information that way. So we're definitely going to ask around that. But I also know Dr. Michael Bugh, who is and I've asked him at length this summer around. He is the head. He does the mushroom toxicology for North America. And asked him, I said, what kind of things are you seeing, you know, when people are reporting mushrooms or any adverse things around psilocybin? And he says, mostly it's just stomach upset.
Right.
And so then you have to wonder if it's just, you know, that the mushrooms they got had bacterial contamination. They were older ones, or maybe their microbiome is off, because, you know, we have all these neurotransmitters in our gut. And if you don't have a healthy biome, that maybe eating mushrooms is not for you.
Yeah, so I guess one of the impacts of, or one of the outcomes of your clinical trials could be leading towards the psychedelics being legalized. Is that one of your hopes?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, these have to come back to use. There's no doubt in my mind. I don't know what it's like in where you guys are, but in Canada, we have an opioid crisis that's a pandemic.
Right.
And we know psilocybin can help for addiction. We know MDMA can help for trauma and PTSD, which is often at the heart of addiction. And the medications and the therapies we have right now are inadequate for the task. And we know the success rates of these. We have to bring them back. There's just no question about it. We know psilocybin mushrooms, they've been around for millennia. We know they are safe. We know they're effective. And so just like anything, any other product that's brought to market, it still has to go through good clinical practices. It has to be made available to the consumer safely. And we can do that. We have that technology. I mean, there's vitamins and herbs on the market. There's pharmaceuticals on the market. We know how to do it. And so absolutely, we have to bring these back. People, you have to have access to these. I'm not against drugs. I use drugs all the time for my patients when they're indicated, but I want the best one.
Yeah.
I don't want the shittiest one. Excuse my language. I want the best one. And, you know, I'm treating all my patients as if they're my best, most cherished person. What would I want if I was in their situation? I don't want a medication that I have to be on for the rest of life if I have a choice of a medication that I can take once or twice and get on with my life. Right. And for some people, they will need, like, microdosing, I think, has got a huge future. I think there will be, like, we will be looking at microdosing in the very near future as almost like a daily vitamin.
Right.
So all of the stigma around it is wrong. It's based on falsehoods. And we have to be courageous and say that, this is crap. And these will be legal. There will be. There's no doubt. Too many people are getting well. We want wellness.
Yeah.
We want wellness, like we do. And it's not in opposition to the pharmaceutical model. Like there will be portions of this that could be made into a very distinct pill that is a prescription. Great. There's going to be some conditions that we will want that. But then you also have the right, though, to have, you know, a psychedelic experience. You have the right to your own consciousness. You have the right to your own wellness. And no one should be able to say you don't.
Thank you so much to Pamela for taking the time to talk to us and share the work that's been done in Canada. And if you're interested in finding out more about her projects, go to rootstothrive.com or microdose.me. But it's not just Canada that's researching this subject. There are extensive programs looking into it in other places, such as Australia and the UK too, at the Centre for Psychedelic Research at Imperial College London. And there's also a series of clinics called Awaken Life Clinics that deliver psychedelic-assisted therapy as a treatment for mental health and addiction, combining talking therapy with sessions assisted by psychedelics, which in the UK currently is ketamine assisted therapy. So this is something that is happening and growing and being researched and talked about more and more on a global scale.
And I really loved what she said at the end, or the way that she said it's not legal yet, and that it has to be shifted from class A back to use.
Yeah.
So that this research can take place,
yeah.
And so people can access, because we have access to so many drugs.
Yeah.
And if these drugs can really help with mental health and physical health, then I think it's really important that this research is being done.
The benefits that she was seeing in her patients sound like they're pretty life-changing, actually.
Yeah.
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 These things are slow-moving wheels, aren't they? Slow-moving wheels, is that a phrase? Like turning a tanker?
I don't know. It is now. I knew exactly what you meant.
You did, thanks.
And but I love that, she's at the forefront of it. And I just really hope that, life becomes much easier for people wanting to research it, for scientists wanting to research it.
Yes, absolutely.
Bloody Nixon, honestly.
I know. It's crazy to think that they didn't even have access to it in a controlled laboratory environment for research purposes. Like, literally, it was not available.
Yeah.
That's nuts, isn't it? I hadn't realised that at all.
Decades have been wasted.
Yeah, completely.
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting because this is something that I've not experimented with. I've never experimented with microdosing or any psychedelic drug, to be honest with you. Mm. But I've gone into researching this topic and this episode with like a totally open mind. And I've been so blown away and so fascinated by the information that Pamela shared with us. But it is something that you've had some experience with. Is that fair for me to say, Gwen?
Yes, it is. I did weigh up whether to say, actually, well, no, I've never tried it. I did not inhale, officer, but I have got a friend who has. And then I thought, you know what? I've been talking about this plenty. So, yes, we all know that I have, in the name of research and in the name of making myself feel good, have been experimenting with microdosing over the last couple of years. And it was after, I don't know if we talked about this on an earlier episode, it was after reading this article in The Guardian.
Yes.
About all these women in their kind of 30s, 40s, 50s who were all, they were using different psychedelics to, and microdosing. So yeah. Like it would be a 16th of a tab or, you know, a couple of mushrooms. To basically kind of get their lives back and to feel themselves again and to bring back joy and creativity into their lives.
Yeah.
So I read that article and I was like, I want in.
Yeah. And let me play.
And so, at first somebody lent me some mushroom oil and I was just really keen to do as little as possible. And I had like a little moment of like being like a little spark of joy, but I didn't really feel that was doing much. Then I moved back to West Wales, where it grows in the fields.
Life lived close to nature.
Yeah. And you are allowed, you are actually allowed to like pick it and eat it, but you're not, is my understanding, you're not allowed to possess it. So, hello, loophole. So,
let me dive straight through you.
I became a keen walker with a stoop.
Suddenly, Gwen was out on the moors day and night. Oh, look, it's Gwen. She likes her hiking, doesn't she?
She's so fit and healthy, that
such
one.
Such a keen rambler.
Such a keen rambler. These are words that have never been said about me before in my life. So anyway, I distinctly remember my first successful microdosing episode where I took like two or three mushrooms and then cleaned up my whole house. And I was literally like skipping down the hallways and I was doing all the washing up and all these little jobs that I'd meant to do like 6 months before, like move that plug or get that multi-plug or put it in that corner. Yeah. Foo, foo, foo.
Boom.
I was doing it all. Yeah. And that's one of the things it says about it, that they say about it. It can really just make you productive.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, she was talking about the difference between a micro and a mini dose. And I've definitely, as I was kind of experimenting with doses, veered more into a mini dose. So I remember washing up one time and I spilt so much water on the floor. I was standing there crying, laughing, bent over double. And then what happens is, I think because it kind of... it is rewiring your brain, basically, and it's shifting something in your brain. And I found that during the week afterwards, because I was doing it every Sunday, during the week afterwards, I would be really laughing at stuff that you say I was watching on telly and really laughing loudly and bent over double crying again.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, I feel like I'm unlocking something.
Okay.
So that was really successful. And then I have also done macro dosing, which is where you deliberately do a large dose. Uh-huh. And that is to, like she was talking about, we've got all this conditioning. We've got our neural pathways that are well entrenched and well bedded in.
Yeah.
And it basically does clear all that away.
Yeah.
And I was going through a little something. Oh, God, I was trying to get over a boy.
Oh, God,
that
boy.
No. And a friend recommended what you need is a big dose. And I teamed it with, there is an album by John Hopkins. Funnily enough, not the John Hopkins that she was talking
the
about.
The research hospital.
The research. I know. But this is the musician, John Hopkins, who does music for psychedelic therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did a macro dose while listening to that. And honestly, you just get... you're taken on a bit of a journey through this album. But what I really quickly found is that none of that shit mattered, you know? Like the stuff I was stressing about, the stuff I was worried about, none of that shit mattered. And all that mattered was love. Like I just felt love and I felt compassion.
Yeah.
And it was truly remarkable. I mean, funnily enough, for some odd reason, I ended up washing up that night as well.
This is your go-to activity.
I end up cleaning up my kitchen.
I've just got
but
visions.
But while dancing.
I've just got visions of your kitchen, like in normal times, just being absolutely floor to ceiling, dirty pots and pans. Yeah. Suddenly you roll in. Yep. Let me at it. Every
it's
Sunday.
Time. But yeah, and it just... it was like we discussed in the interview, it was like a reset button.
Mm.
I just kind of felt cleansed in some way, but it was just really good to kind of reconnect with my kind of source in a way, or reconnect with the source and just feel love. And yeah, I think it really works for me.
Yes.
And but you know, I don't think it's like a one hit fix. Like, I saw this documentary the other day called Magic Medicine. And they were treating people with severe depression. And these are patients who treatment hasn't worked for them so far. Yeah. And for some of the patients, it was really effective. And they were back to normal and they were engaging with their family again. But it didn't last for all the patients. So I guess this is what they're working out in the research.
Yes.
And I do feel that in my own experience, that microdosing, it's something that you need to top the levels up of. Some people do it every few days or, you know, once a week or something.
Well, this is what I found so interesting about our chat with Pamela, because, I mean, we went into it. We started off researching this episode about microdosing, didn't we? Specifically, you know, developers in Silicon Valley, Gwen in her kitchen, that level of microdosing. And I hadn't realised before we started looking into it and talking to her that there was this whole wider field of therapeutic use that's been researched. And yeah, there's still a lot of unanswered questions, aren't there? Mm. But that is being researched and looked into that could treat some help people through really serious, debilitating conditions that they're living with and that they're trying to find their way through. Mm. And I hadn't realised there was that whole world of research that's been done out there.
Yes.
So watch this space, really.
Yeah.
This research is ongoing, isn't it? I mean, we tried to speak to some people from the Psychedelic Research Centre at Imperial College in London, and they were just so busy. They seemed, you know, very friendly people. They're just like, we are so busy, we can't squeeze right up my podcast into our hectic schedules.
Don't you know who we are?
Come on. Gwen's moved that plug, quick. Get us in the schedule. But this research has been done. I mean, we all know, don't we, that sort of California and Canada, these countries, their rules are slightly different to ours. But this research is going on in the UK as well.
Yeah. And I'm for one, am very grateful to have read that article and to have started my own journey with it. And I do think that it's been very helpful. And but also, you know, it is a psychedelic, and people can have bad trips. And I've very lucky that that's not been my experience. But you know, I've certainly felt that, you know, if I've taken them and I've been out, I've certainly had experiences where I've felt quite disconnected from everybody around me, and it's taken me a while to kind of find my place. So yeah, you know, they're drugs, aren't they? So they're going to alter how you feel. So it's going to be different for everyone who takes them.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm.
So now, Kate, this is where I would usually ask you if you would do it again. This episode is a little bit different. So maybe I'll ask you instead, would you consider doing this? Would you microdose?
Well, I don't know how to answer that question. I guess the whole point of this podcast is that we're really honest and we're open and that we share our experiences. But this episode does feel slightly different, and the nature of what we're talking about feels slightly different. And, well, you know, we often end episodes saying, yeah, I'm going to make part of my everyday life routine. And I know that this is something that is part of your life routine and is really helping you. But it's not something that's been part of my world, and it's not something that's been on my radar. But like I said earlier, I have loved researching and making this episode so much. And I found Pamela so fascinating and enlightening.
Yeah.
And like, in answer to what you're asking me, is this something that I might use in my life? I guess I don't know. I don't know what the future might look like, but it's left me really open-minded about it all. That's probably the best way to put how I feel about it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. And I think it's great that you can go from knowing very little about it to being curious and being open to it. So
yeah,
I think that's as much as we can hope for, really.
Yeah. So Gwen, would you keep doing this? Will you keep doing this? Is this something that you feel like you want to keep being part of your life?
Yes. I think that it is, so long as it grows in my backyard, I'm very happy to keep using it as part of my toolkit, really. as part of my range of things that help me to feel good, because it does make me feel good. So it's a big thumbs up from me.
Great.
Yeah, and I just really hope, I really, really hope that with all the research that's going on and with, you know, demystifying the effects and also showing the really positive impacts of it, that it can become more accessible for everybody else, and it could be moved from Class A back to use, and so people can, you know, so lots of people who really deserve to have access to its benefits can.
Yeah, in a nutshell, in a natty little summing up, yeah. That's what natty means.
That's what natty means. Little...
We've come full circle.
At last. Thank you for listening to Write Up My Podcast.
Yeah, the last episode of season 3. How time flies when you're having fun. I have loved this season.
Yes.
I found the range of subjects we've done so fascinating. I've got so much out of it personally.
Yeah.
It's been brilliant.
Yeah, same. We've had such great feedback as well from this season.
Oh, we really have, haven't we? And do you know what? I would love to encourage listeners. We're going to have a little break now while we research and get set for the next season. If there's something, if there's a subject you would love us to look into doing, then get in touch. Let us know.
Yes.
Because we love that. And some of our episodes have been birthed out of a suggestion by a listener. So do get in touch.
Yes. Even better, if you've got somebody in mind that you would like us to talk to.
Yeah.
We are all ears. We would love to hear from you.
Absolutely. So as always, you can email us at writeupmypodcast@gmail.com, and you can find us on Instagram and Twitter using our handle @writeupmy.
Please subscribe and follow wherever you listen. And if you've got the time and or the inclination and the love, please head on over to Apple and give us a rating and a review. 5 stars, please.
And why not check out our Patreon page, www.patreon.com/writeupmypodcast, where during our break, I don't want to commit us to anything here, Gwen, that we're not going to do.
Come on, let's bloody commit to it.
You'll find some fabulous extra content, Gwen and I chatting to our heart's content.
Every week.
Every week. So head over there for a little bit of extra Gwen and Kate. And thank you to our team, our fabulous team, which comprises of you, Gwen, me, Kate.
And also Andy Grimes, who does the awesome music, and
so
Erica
good.
Francis George, who hand cuts all of our titles.
So
she's
amazing.
Pretty blooming awesome.
Blooming talented. And we won't be back in a couple of weeks. We'll be back in a couple of months with the next season of Write Up My Podcast. But meanwhile, keep trying things
to make you feel good. Bye-bye.
Tell me, did you like the podcast, Brian?
No!
Oh. If, unlike Brian, you thought our podcast was really great, then don't hold back, like, subscribe, and tell your mate. But if, like Brian, you thought our podcast wasn't fun, then just keep quiet, don't feel the need to tell anyone. Oh, we'd love to hear from you if you've got some thoughts to share. Such rich and lovely views that all should be aware of. But I hope you liked our podcast and you thought it was really great. And if you did, like, subscribe, and tell your mate. 'Cause we don't need grumpy pants bringing everybody down. No, we don't need negative Nellies making people frown. No. So I hope you liked our podcast and you thought it was really great. And if you did, like, subscribe, and tell your mate.